I think that ultimately, when you look at where trends are and what's happening and where things are going, it really comes down to how do you do two things? How do you move data around? How do you use it to advantage?
Welcome to the Leaders of B2B podcast, a weekly show where we bring you interviews and in-the-weeds expertise with today's B2B experts and thought leaders. You can see more about today's episode and guest by visiting our website at leadersofb2b.com.
Hey, leaders, welcome back. This is Ledge. Today, I'm welcoming Charles Yeomans to the show. Charles, I went through your extensive LinkedIn. I would not do it justice in any way. So I would love if you would do an introduction of yourself and your work to the audience, and we'll get started.
Yeah, thanks, Ledge. Appreciate that. So I've been around. I was once at an interview, actually, at business school in which a Goldman Sachs partner accused me of being a Renaissance man. He didn't mean it a compliment. I was a Navy intelligence officer, got my MBA at Stanford, worked on Wall Street for a while, and it was a pretty interesting experience. I really enjoyed a lot of aspects, but I also got the bug to go inside and into management, be one of my clients. And so first joined a company as a COO of an insurance broker in New York, a big one. And that was a really interesting experience, very, very challenging, very positive, but informative because it said, yeah, that's the direction I want to go. Then I was recruited by a PE fund to go back to California and take over as CEO of an acquisition they were making. And we managed that for a while and pretty successfully and did a lot of tech stuff with it, building kind of a benefits enrollment platform and so forth. And we sold that. And then I took a left turn. This was my brother's the head of pain research at Stanford. And he needed help in raising money for a biotech. And so I said, okay, but that's all. But then they went through this process of the CEO was leaving. We had somebody who wanted to invest in it. Turns out it was a venture fund in Santiago, Chile. So I tracked down. It's like one of those things. So at any rate, and they needed somebody to be at least a placeholder CEO so we get the commitment. So I said, and they talked me into it. And so I went down there and I really don't know anything. I didn't. Now I do some. About biotech. So we went down to Chile. They gave us a couple of million and we got it off the ground. And it was like, this is crazy. It was definitely a left turn, but then it went okay. And we ended up selling the assets. But it wasn't a spectacular win. It was a really great drug for chronic migraine and it could be a great thing. But we did get a buyer. It wasn't like it was a total failure or something. It just didn't work that great. But then I ran into this guy, lives actually pretty near me, who had this unbelievable idea for technology. And I was debating what I was going to do and more on the financial engineering kind of stuff and everything. Like I've got a lot of background in, but I really like technology. And the thing he described to me was like, I said, there's no way that this hasn't been done or somebody hasn't thought of it. And so I went and talked to some lawyers at some big time patent law firms and so forth. And everybody said, nope, that's a clear field. And it was such a fundamental thing. And it's so obvious when you really think about it. It's one of these things like a light bulb or something. It's so simple, but so fundamental and so much a game changer. And so, and I couldn't resist it. And so I did it. And so then here we are.
All right. So you got, gosh, what a buildup. I mean, you got the visionary CEO thing down. So you're like, come on, Dish, what is this?
It's really this, that most of the data that is in running around in all these systems everywhere, all over the place, the fastest growing part of it is IoT, the Internet of Things, the things, machine generated data. And the thing about it is it's very repetitive stuff. But it'll be like it's 72 degrees and I'm sensor number blah, 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 and my battery's fine and so forth. Boom, boom, every second, every millisecond, whatever. And all that And it, just to give you a sense of scale, like in 2025, there's going to be about 90 zettabytes that gets generated by IoT, according to IDC. 90 zettabytes. And if you add up, to give you a sense of scale, if you add up the storage capacity of all the data centers in the world, it's about 2 zettabytes, which shows you there's a big difference here in the amount of data and what you can do with it, where it goes and all that stuff. Yeah, and you don't need to keep it all, but you want to send a lot of it places. And so how do you get to be, how do you get this data to be a lot more efficient and to not use compression? Because compression, these datagrams, the little messages are too small for compression. And so your choice is, okay, I'm not going to send a lot of it because I can't have, I don't have the capacity, or I'm going to wait until I have a whole bunch of it and smash it together and then apply compression to it, a bunch of batching, but it's not real time anymore. And so what do you do? And so this idea is basically saying, all right, give me a sample of this data. It might be a few hundred kilobytes, a megabyte or something. And then we, what we do is we look in the payloads for patterns that repeat. And so they might be 128 bits or 64 or 200 or something. And we find that pattern and we'd say, okay, we see this 128-bit pattern all the time. And so we put it in a code book and we assign a little index, a little code word to it. And so you'd say, okay, this 128-bit pattern, and if it's really frequently observed, then you'd say 3-bit code word. If it's a lot less, then it might be 10-bit code word. And so you use machine learning to build this thing, and it builds it in a matter of a couple of minutes. And usually, and as soon as you're done, you take that code book, you put it in the source and in the destination. And now all you're doing in runtime is a lookup. You just whack up the payload. You'd say, okay, 128 bits, chop, and then it does a quick lookup. And basically, it's replacing the payload with code words. And on average, we get about 75% smaller overall datagrams. But you're doing it in microseconds. And so the result of all this is you can move 4 times more data over the same pipe.
You have, of course, this gets into, I used to write code like this. So you're dusting off old brain cells. But I'm wondering about, like, how do you handle the chance the machine X got swapped and nobody told you, and the datagram format all of a sudden changed, right?
Yeah, we have something we call the dynamic code book. And what it does is it'll monitor in different ways. You could say, okay, on average, we're getting 75%. And let's say we're getting 75%. And we could set a little meter thing that says, okay, when we get to, if it gets to 70%, build a new code book and does that. And so if you swap things out, it does things automatically. It's a SaaS.
Is there a hardware component? How do you offload the data?
Yeah. So it's right now it's built in AWS, and we use, when we're in Greengrass, if you're familiar with that, which just is like a container that gets pushed out into whatever the gadget is. And but we're also working, like, we have a couple of...
You have to live on the firmware also?
No, not really. So that's a goal. Right now we're sitting in the software layer, and what we perceive here, let me mention a couple other quick things about it that makes it really different and weird.
The whole audience just fell asleep, but I'm nerding out. So
one of the things is, so compressed data, you can't randomly access it. You can't search it. To do anything with it, you have to decompress it, right? Our stuff, no. You can randomly access and search it just as though it was not. So long as you load the code book in the RAM, then the whole thing is just as visible to that computer, which is a big deal. And when you think about what it can do and how that affects things in a data center or in anything, and now suddenly all this reduced size data is now just as visible to the computer as if it wasn't reduced. That's a profound difference. And that's why we have...
You're right. It is like one of those things you're like, damn, that's so easy. Why didn't I think of that?
Exactly. And then, but we have a bunch of patents, so we can't do anything. We have actually 36 patents so far, and another 40 more pending. So
that speaks to your business acumen, right? Your experience was necessary there to go, wait a second, how do I even know this is unique? And if it is, batten down the hatches, because this is not hard to replicate unless we get that protection. And I wonder if the experience of drug design and approval would, because it's very similar.
Yeah. Because, and especially with the drug we were working with, which, so there's in drugs, you have method patents and composition of matter, right? And the method patents, you can't get very far. You've got to have composition of matter. And so what do you do to get to that? And it's a whole strategy thing that's a big deal. And we had the composition of matter, but
it's the same thing, but you applied it in a different domain, which goes to your Renaissance man. Like, that's multidisciplinary innovation is in business. I'll come right in on that.
I appreciate that. We have a great partner in our patent firm. It's Galvin Patent Law, and small firm, but they are great. And we think, man, they're just terrific firm. And small firm, they're all over it and do a great job. And we just bang them out, bang out those patents.
Yeah.
So in the, I should mention one more piece of this, because there's all these dimensions. Because when you're thinking about a technology that can really change how things really work in a virtually any system, one of the key things is security, right? And one of the things that we're doing here is the first reaction you get is like, well, it's a substitution cipher if you're talking about anything to do with, you know, but it's so...
Which as an intelligence analyst, you would know.
Right. It's true. But it's also massively random. And so when you have thousands of randomness in it, it makes it very challenging. And we have a new version that actually doubles it up because it does encryption too. And we haven't released that yet, but it's formidable when you think about, okay...
It's so much randomness that you almost have a public-private key pairing without having to worry about encryption.
Exactly. Our customers don't add encryption. They don't need to, because it would take, when the estimate of our mathematicians and stuff, it would take a national effort. That is to say, a big computer in another country working for a long time, because we're not talking about something that, if you're thinking about the Enigma or something, you'd say the letter A. Fundamentally, you're getting to the letter A. And this, you're getting to a pattern in right. data. So nothing in the real world.
Right. And you don't even know how long the pattern is necessarily. So you have so much dimensionality in the data.
And it's not 26 plus nine digits or 10. It's thousands and thousands of these little patterns that are meaningless without context.
It's actual security by obfuscation with the natural order of things. It's super interesting. I could nerd out about that all day.
It's really something else, because at first, so we have a great mathematician who's also a professor. His name is Josh Cooper. And I first said, isn't this security, you know, because it seems like this would be very hard. Oh, no, it's just substitution cycle. Everybody will poke holes in it. And then he went back and really thought about it. And he said, yeah, it is. It's sort of reluctantly a little, but he did agree that, yes, it's pretty heavy duty, actually.
Because you introduced that dimension of scale that is so outrageously large that now makes me think, is the next generation of the quantum and everything, it actually would help you sidestep that too, because if it's actual randomness, then the probabilities break down completely.
Well, you know, and especially in this...
So you saw quantum encryption too.
I don't guarantee that, but it's funny. In the new version, which eliminates any possibility of using statistical hacking, because it's combining it with encryption, but it doesn't add another step. It's the same step. And the combo would be very tough. You can't be sure with it. It's not enough thinking and so forth with quantum yet, but... It would certainly be a big challenge. And would it be? Hard to say, but it would be very tough to hack into it. And the cool thing is, it's just a side benefit. It's not something you do anything extra to do. Main thing you're wanting to do is reduce the amount of data so you can send more data and blah, blah, blah. And
Yeah, there's an analogy to zero trust just by pounding so much data through that it wouldn't even be worth trying to solve it because there's easier targets to vector.
That's one of the reasons why. So we've got a Space Force contract that we're working on right now. They're really keen. They have a bunch of satellites that they are launching. They call them the Tranche satellites, and they're supporting tactical efforts. And how do you get the data moving from space to the ground or from the ground up through a satellite to back down to the ground and so forth? It's all about sending lots of data. And there's only so much capacity you can put in a satellite, et cetera, et cetera. That's why Viasat's working with us too. It's the same general idea. And I should mention, so we have a second product that we're working on with the Air Force right now, another contract. And this one we call NIRCOM. And what NIRCOM does is it is an AI that retrofits onto codecs. And so it applies to lossy compression potential. And it gets more or less around twice as many images of the same quality through a pipe. And right now we're focused on synthetic aperture radar images. And those are an example of the kinds of images that we're focused, like hyperspectral, LIDAR, those kinds of things.
You could easily see deep space applications.
And there's no reason why it wouldn't work with plain old RGB, but you know, we don't want to say, okay, we're going head to head against Netflix or something. It's like not the plan. So, but the idea is that we want to be able to offer a full solution and not just say, okay, we'll handle this data, but not that data. We want to say, we'll handle all your data.
Sure, sure. Any CDN would be interested in such an innovation for sure.
Yeah, I know.
We're talking about financing such a venture, and I'd love to hear you talk about that. I think that's really interesting too.
Yeah. So as I mentioned before, like, you know, yeah, I went to Stanford. I got my MBA there. I have lots of buddies who are venture guys and all that. But what I really think is cool is the idea of everything isn't all just an inside game. I like the idea of making, we could be a unicorn. And this is like a big time game changer opportunity. For me, I love the idea of not just having it available only to this group of insiders who are the PE guys and the venture guys. I like the idea of it being available to regular people. And so what we've done is we've gone the crowdfunding route, which is pretty unusual, especially given, okay, we got this deep tech, hard to explain sort of technologies and everything. And they're really cool. And it's probably not the easiest route, but I really think it's neat to be able to get out there and do this crowdfunding thing. And we've raised more money than probably all but a handful, because most of the crowdfunding stuff's a few hundred thousand kind of stuff. And we've raised $8.5 million on Start Engine so far. And we are hoping to have another offering start. And I can't talk much about it, but there'll be a link on our website and there'll also be something Start Engine if we, because like you got to do all this stuff with SEC and filing and blah, blah, blah. And it's like,
and this is all based on the Jobs Act, right? That was the structure around the pay. We can now raise money from non-accredited.
And so, like last year on December 28th, we ended our last round and we were able to convey the message, I think, pretty effectively, because the max we could raise under, so there's two regulations, Reg CF, which is for smaller, you can't raise more than $5 million a year under Jobs Act. And then there's Reg A Plus, which is really Reg A, but it's tweaked a little for crowdfunding. And that's like limited, I think, to $75 million a year or something that is going to be not an issue for us. But last year,
only 75. Yeah.
So this last one, which it closed in December, we were seeking 2 million. And what we had so many people come in and want to invest that we raised it to the max we could under the regulation, which is to 3.1. And so we maxed that out. And then we had another 3.6 that were on the wait list when we closed it that we couldn't accept. And it was like, we're getting the word out here. Plus, we had like, you know, an outfit investor place that came out and recommended it. And it was like a lot of noise. And so it was a very successful offering. And the Start Engine advocated we should open and do another round of Reg A Plus. And so we're working on that. No guarantees, blah, blah, blah.
I did look at it, and it's you're at 3.3 already of people on the wait list here. So
I know. And I'm doing a webinar actually in an hour or so. I do them every month because part of it is the way you do this stuff, it's very different. It's retail stuff. You're not sitting there like across the desk from the CTO of a company. You're talking to people who are surprising how well you think about what we're doing, right? We're not talking about what most people construe to be the normal thing for crowdfunding, which would be like a brewery or a restaurant chain, something that consumerist stuff that people participate and understand. This is obviously, sure. But people really do get it. And they do get their head around it. And it's not like it's some obscure technical protocol.
No, I mean, you could draw a picture of this. Like, here's what your smart fridge is doing, whether or not you should have a smart fridge, let's be honest. But your Fitbit, like any of these things, like they're all doing this in order to give you real life benefits. So that edge, that tangential nature of edge for consumer makes it a pretty easy system to think about. You just didn't ever think about it.
That's right. In its essence, as you pointed out right in the beginning, it's a really simple concept. And the NERCOM thing, there's a lot of fancy math and tweaking and neural net and all that business. But when neural net, nobody really knows what's going on and all the in the middle of it. You got the beginning and you got the end, and then there's a lot of things lighting up. Right. And it's too complicated, but this, it just makes sense. And it also makes sense that machines are sending a lot more data all the time. And there's no way that everything can be handled right out of the box. Impossible.
And it's the same problem, no matter what, for any network infrastructure, right down to the fiber lines down the street. Like anything you could do to increase the availability of open pipe, everybody's going to understand that because their internet slowed down at one point or another and it sucked.
Well, that's right. We have really, I would say, the list of big companies that are interested talking to us have reached out just like an info at like Mitsubishi, Chevron, and like all these like companies that go, you're going like, this guy just reached out to us. Everybody's got the same thing. Everybody has the same issue. Yeah. How do I get more data through this pipe? And it may be very specific, like you take oil and gas, offshore, all that stuff has to go over satellite. Satellite's pretty constrained, and they send boatloads over satellites.
Or railroad systems, or gosh, anything that's out there in the middle of nowhere. Like you're not talking about ubiquitous broadband. You're talking like kilobytes a lot.
Yeah, exactly. And how do I skinny this down? And it goes down to even this to say, you made a point earlier about getting into the hardware. We're working with some hardware companies now that have one of them, it's called Zephyr Computing. They have what they call supercomputers in space. So they're hardened systems that can handle radiation and all that stuff. And we're working with them to load it in. And there's other, like maybe some to an extent DOD or NASA or that kind of thing, oriented things. As you obviously know, there's a lot of commercial going into space now, and it's all constrained. Everybody wants to send more data than they have capacity to send. And anything you can do there that can help them, especially a cheap little bit of software, is great. And so step one for us is to build. Actually, if you think about it, if you're, say you're a geo operator like Viasat, and you have whatever it is now, since they bought Inmarsat, like 30 satellites or something, each one is half a billion or whatever. If you have a way of getting our stuff onto the things that are sending the data over, suddenly we have four times more satellites. In half a billion each, this is cheaper. And so cheap is relative, right?
So you can sell it for $490,000.
Well, $490 million. At any rate, so the other thing about it is, how do you make this as ubiquitous as it can be? And what really says, get into chips?
That's what I was going to say. You have to go to the silicon. Yeah,
exactly. So in step one is FPGAs. And in the case of NeurCom, it'll be GPUs. But the FPGAs will be both, will have both NeurCom and compaction in it, or just compaction. Because you're never going to send just images. You're either sending images and data, telemetry, et cetera, or you're just sending telemetry and tracking and control and stuff. So all that means, though, how do you make this ubiquitous? You really need to be ultimately in ASICs and IP cores. But the step one is FPGAs. And I'll tell you, the Air Force Research Laboratory and the Space Force and the Navy, they're all like all over FPGAs. And they like the fact that you can reprogram them instead of having to replace the chip and the board. And the idea would be slap it on the logic board, a little FPGA, and then shove a new board into your fighter plane or whatever it is, and you're off to the races. And suddenly now you're communicating way more data. And it's a huge issue. You think about what DoD does. Most platforms in DoD communicate using something called Link 16. Link 16 is a 1980s tech, and this is their main backbone way of communicating. It's 1980s tech. It's either 27 kbps, 57, or maybe it's 25 or something. It's 57 or 111 kbps.
You're talking about like our old school dial-up modems.
Yeah. I'm talking about that. You've got mail time, and you've got 21st century super-duper airplanes that generate gigabits trying to squeeze it down and send it over a pipe that's got typically 57 kilobits. There's a bit of a differential there.
That's your 1995 dial-up.
Yeah. And not only that, they want to send images. They want to send all kinds of stuff. And if you look at like the Navy released those things of like those, they call it the thing that looked like a tic-tac, the with UFOs or the little, anyway, they release images once in a while from gun cameras. And they're really grainy black and white stuff. And the reason that's true is because they're sending it over Link 16. And Link 16 just is really limited bandwidth. And that NeurCom could help with. But what they're trying to do now is they have a master aircraft and might be manned, and it usually is, but some of them be unmanned. You also have a lot of drones. And all those drones need to be controlled, handled, everything. And there's a lot of data that moves back and forth. What are you going to do? And so, not surprisingly, the admiral who's in charge of moving all that data had a long conversation with us. And one of our recently added board members is the guy, the admiral, who used to run the Naval Information Warfare Systems Command, which is 11,000 people in the Navy who are the guys that make the decisions about what acquisitions to make and so forth. So, and he sees us as a game changer for the Navy. They have a huge amount of data. They send more data over satellites than anybody. Because why? Because they're out at sea all the time.
Sure. And everybody who owns a cruise line is now lining up to think about that too, so that we can all check our YouTube while we're cruising.
Well, try sending data acoustically underwater. That's 44 bits per second. 44 bits, not kilobits, not gigabits, bits. And they want to send images. It's like, how the hell are you going to do it?
They're going to call you.
Yeah, let's hope so.
Okay, you've got the Renaissance man career, and you touched all kinds of different areas, and you thought about being in just in finance, quote unquote. And this strikes me as one of those sort of like, when you look back at it, how did you get here? Was there some intention? Was it all luck? Luck prepared? What is it? Luck favors the prepared mind. What is that journey? What's the through line for you?
That's a good question. Yeah. Because like you go through your life and you say, that was a pivotal moment. If I had sat there in a room and made a decision to do this instead of that, before I went in the Navy, I was trying to decide whether to become a professor of classics, Greek, Latin, philosophy, history, and so forth.
I mean, Goldman Sachs guy had you nailed, I have to tell you. Yeah.
Anyway, and so I said, I don't want to keep doing this because humanities are not a growing field. And unfortunately, lots of PhDs from pretty high-end places, and that would have been the case with me, are just not able to find jobs. And so they end up as paralegals or something. So I sat in a room and I said, okay, what am I going to do? Am I going to go here and do this or here and do that? Like I had an offer to go on Wall Street then, or I had an offer or I could go to business school. And then I said, it'd be really cool to go out. And I pictured myself on the deck of a carrier, khakis flapping in the winds and everything. And I said, that would be cool. So that's what I got to do. That and the fact that I applied to Harvard and Stanford Business School, and they both said, go get some experience, young man. And so I thought, okay, let's do that. And I thought that would be pretty neat. And so that's what drove that decision. And then I said, but I'm going to leave after 4 years, and I'm going to, the minimum time, and I'm going to go to business school. But then I got to that point, and I got accepted at Stanford, and I was going to go. But then I thought, man, because I was briefing the chief of naval operations and the secretary on intelligence things. And I was like going to the vice president's office and briefing him. And you get heady stuff. And I do recommend to anybody, don't be dismissive of military stuff, because the opportunities for young people, as opposed to, okay, I went to Wall Street and I typed on a computer for three or four years. I got out there. I went to Djibouti, Somalia, Kenya, but all these places that did really cool things. And I was talking to the head people in the whole country and everything. It was totally awesome. And that was why I got, more than anything, why I got into Stanford B School. That being said, I've never been absolutely sure that it was a good idea to leave, because I was tracking. Who knows what the future could have held for me in the Navy. So it was one of those things you never can be sure about. The crazy thing about the biotech, I can't explain, okay? He was my brother and everything. It's not really an excuse, but he needed the help. But overall, though, I think don't be afraid to take a chance and do something that you don't know diddly squat about, and just try it anyway. Because if you're smart, and I'm not claiming I am, I'm saying if you think you can figure things out, have a little adventure. Don't just track along the straight and narrow. It may not ultimately land you with the most money that you possibly could make, you know, and everything, but have an interesting life. Do something different. Do something that's challenging, but satisfying. It rings your intellectual bell. At any rate, that would be my little bit of wisdom. And the Goldman guy, ultimately, I'm not going to claim to be a Renaissance man, but I would claim that I had a more interesting background than a lot of folks might have had otherwise. I like a lot of different things. I like variety. I like trying things. And I don't think there's really anything wrong with it.
What's the more technical word? Is it polymath? Is that?
You know, you have to learn all the time, forever. And you don't stop just because, oh, okay, I now have a full mastery of my profession and I'm just going to do it. Ka-chunk. I was walking through the airport a couple of days ago and just looking at this long line of those carts they have and thinking about, there's a company that makes those carts and there's hundreds of them in this line. And they have to make the same one over and over. I said, I could not stand that. And I'm not saying it's a bad thing for somebody to do it. Somebody's got to do it. But it's the opposite of how I operate. And I'm saying, if you have an inclination to try something different, don't necessarily say, well, that's not what I do, and so I'm not going to do it.
Fantastic. I love it. Absolutely. So coming up top of the hour, I know you got things to do. Yeah. Real quick, I just like to finish up with what should be on everybody's radar, and no pun intended, since you're probably working on that too.
Yes, that's where you get the radar images. So
the metaphorical radar screen of B2B, what must be there right now?
I think that ultimately, when you look at where trends are and what's happening and where things are going, it really comes down to how do you do two things? How do you move data around? How do you use it to advantage in anybody's system? And I'm not talking about just our stuff. I think our stuff is important for that. The idea of generating tons of data, that's great. But right now, most people don't do anything with most of it. And it's there. It's nice to have. But ultimately, the temperature of this refrigerator in a Walmart in Peoria, Illinois, is never going to go anywhere. It's just going to get tossed out. How do you think through that and make it all useful and decide what is useful? And part of that's going to be an AI, right? And part of that is going to be edge processing. And part of it is going to be shipping off whatever is important to some central point where it can be, again, some bigger AI and people figure out, like, what are you going to do with it? What matters? How is this important? Or is it?
Which is the strategic thinking that we can be elevated to now, given the opportunity to make knowledge and intelligence out of essentially petabytes of nonsense.
It's exactly right. Because you think about what 90 zettabytes is, and it doesn't sound like that much because it's not billions or something, but it's a lot. And there's so much of it.
It's what, more than billions. Yeah.
It's more than trillions.
It's more than you could possibly even conceptualize.
So what do you do with all that? You got to be rational about it. And you got to think about, like, how do I use this to improve productivity, to improve everything? Because there's so much potential there, huge potential. And it can do so much more than it can do now. And how do you figure out, like, between crunching it, moving it around, deciding what's important? That whole thing with IoT is going to change everything. And we're just on the beginning. It's just starting.
Right. What's the day? Yeah, it's like computers are the dumbest they're ever going to be today.
True. In about the next 100 years or whatever, until we are fully cyborgs ourselves.
And we won't live to see it unless they figure out how to store us.
No, just your head. You just cut your head off and keep that.
I don't know. Neil Stephenson would say differently. Charles, thank you so much. Really insightful. I just am grateful for your time. So cool to have this conversation. Anybody wants to follow along, follow you? What are the best of that?
You know, so because of the crowdfunding on the Start Engine site, we're always like sending out, we have an email sign up list you can use. You go to our site and you can do that. And if you're actually interested in the tech, we have a new release coming up probably end of next month. So info@adambeamtech.com. That's our thing. But yeah, I invite anybody, check it out. And we've got a lot of cool stuff happening. We've added a bunch of new staff. We've added a new board. There's a lot of interesting things that are going on with us right now. Yeah, come on down.
Keep your eyes on Adam Beam Tech. Thank you so much for hanging out. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, same here, Ledge. Thanks very much. Appreciate your time.
Thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoyed this episode of the Leaders of B2B podcast. And as always, you can see more information about this episode and all the resources mentioned at leadersofb2b.com. If you enjoyed the show, please give us a 5-star rating. This episode is brought to you by Content Allies. We help B2B companies launch revenue-generating podcasts. We schedule interviews between you and your ideal prospects and strategic partners. You show up for engaging conversations. We handle everything else. Ready to build a podcast that grows your business in just 1 hour per week? Reach out to us at contentallies.com.